All right. Good morning, everybody. Welcome. Hope you had a very good weekend and a great Valentine's Day and freshman fall. I saw lots of pictures on social media, which were a lot of fun. So thank you for that. And congratulations to those of you who were nominated and took part in that in various ways. This morning, we have, may or may not have noticed, we don't have the broadcast with us this morning, so I promise I would record the lecture. That's what I was doing. They're off. Poor people. They're off at a board meeting in Phoenix. So anyway, well, we should keep them in our prayers that the weather doesn't get to you too much. Today, we're going to talk about slavery here in a moment. Not actually slavery, but the way people perceive slavery and class structure. But before we get to that, I do want to remind you that you should be working on your major paper for me. And just this morning, and I hope if this helps anybody, let me know, but there was a magazine, a journal, that was out for 14 years, and it went defunct about 5 years ago, but it was called North and South. And it was one of those, it was a scholarly magazine. I don't even know how to describe it. If you walk into Barnes & Noble, you'll see in their history interest section, they'll always have, you know, World War II and Hitler magazine and all these things. They had one like that called North and South. And it was actually the best of all of those because it was all footnoted, all academic, but also laid out with really beautiful graphics. So I subscribed to that for years and had the hard copies, but they were getting too many. But I found out this morning that they've actually digitized all of them for $25. So I just bought the whole 14 volumes for $25 about 25 minutes ago. So if you're doing research and you see something, because they're cited everywhere, if you see something North and South, just let me know because I can get that to you right away as a PDF. So I've got all of those now. And obviously I've got a big legal I'm supposed to be sharing them, but you know, it's for academic purposes, so I think we can get away with almost anything. So just let me know if you find those. I know I've been talking to a few of you about religion, and they were actually one of the first journals to take for, believe it or not, it was bizarre that religion in the Civil War hasn't been studied always, but it's only been a kind of thing to do over the last 20 years. So there's a lot in religion and Civil War in those as well. So just let me know. You should be able to find citations for them, and then I can get those to you. So, but do keep working on your paper, and I hope those papers are going well. This morning, what I want to do in this class, we've been talking a lot about Lincoln last week, and we ended with Lincoln's duel against Mark Shields. And one of the things that I didn't really get a chance to talk to you about at that point, and I don't know if I'll go into it now, but I only mentioned that really Mary Todd and Lincoln had a very, very bad marriage, and there's no question about that. And I think one of the things that's maybe disturbing at every level, and it's disturbing that she was so abusive. He never, ever was physical towards her. That's one thing to keep in mind, that there was a lot of abuse in the marriage, but it was always her towards him. But you remember, he's 6'4", and she's like 4'9". So there's a huge disparity in size, but she used to go up to him with broom handles and other things, axe handles, not axes, but axe handles. And when she was really mad at him, she'd just whack him in the back of the head when he didn't know she was coming up behind him. He was physically very abusive. And remember that his father was as well. So there's that. The disturbing part is that Lincoln follows that pattern, the unfortunate pattern of those who simply can't escape their abuse. And they're kind of looking for a spouse who will be simply something equivalent to what the abusive parent was. So I do want you to keep that in mind, that Lincoln is long-suffering in the way that he deals with his marriage. And he's very open that he never, ever loved her. Never once did he love Mary Todd. The reason that he married her was for a lot of obligation, partly because she had pursued him, even though, if you remember, she had also been pursued by Stephen Douglas and by others. And there's kind of a famous moment when someone asks her, you know, as First Lady, why would you ever have married Abraham Lincoln when it's so clear you have a terrible relationship with him? And she said, and I can pull up the quote exactly, I don't have it in front of me, but I've been teaching this enough that I have it almost memorized. She said, well, if you look at the man, you'll know that I never married him for his looks. I only married him because I knew he would be president one day. And that is almost certainly the case of why she married him. She was very, very aggressive. in her social position. So just remember that a lot of Lincoln's life is not only shaped by his own depression, but he keeps getting into situations that deepen that depression as well. And he's going to have to deal with that in a lot of different ways. But what I want to do today, since we've talked about that, I do want to talk a little bit about Lincoln's views on slavery. And we're going to spend a lot of time with this for the rest of the class, because Lincoln has a view that's going to evolve very, very strongly. And we'll see that it evolves slowly for about 20 years leading up to the Civil War. It evolves dramatically between about the spring of 1862 and the fall of 1862, and then it revolutionizes around March of 1863. And so a lot of things are going to change very, very dramatically for him. Now, here's one thing we can say about Lincoln. Lincoln was, as far as we know, and the first writings we have from him about anything dealing with slavery go back to 1832. And we know, and of course he's a young man, but remember he's born in 1809. So as early as 1832, and probably earlier, Lincoln had opposed slavery. There's no question about that, that from the very beginning and consistently throughout his entire life, his entire adult life, he was an opponent of slavery. He was, however, and this is where I think we've got to be really careful about this because of what we want to project on the past, he was never an abolitionist. So there's a distinction between being anti-slavery and an abolitionist. In fact, even in the 1850s, when abolitionism was at its height, probably only about a quarter, maybe a half of a percentage of Americans in the North were abolitionists. Abolitionists were not, don't ever think of abolitionists being the Northerners and slavery types being the Southerners. Generally, you had really hardcore anti-slavery people representing the tiniest minority of people in the North, and the extremely pro-slavery people being the tiniest minority in the South. And then you're going to have a back and forth. The vast majority of people had opinions. But just like, if you can think about, I've done this several times, but if you can think about the pro-life movement, you're going to have probably most of us in this room being pro-life. But probably very few of us have ever been activists. We haven't done for exactly like what Laura Smith has done, where she used to stand outside of Planned Parenthood and try and talk women out of going in. That's what I mean by saying there are lots of people who are pro-life, but very few people who live it day to day. The same thing was true with the abolitionists. So there were a lot of people who were anti-slavery. There are very few people who were willing to do anything about it, except have an opinion. So Lincoln was one of those. He really was anti-slavery, but he also had no idea how to go about it. And what we can find consistently with him is that he believed constitutionally there was no power to abolish slavery where it now existed. That is also consistent in all of his thought. He never changes his mind on that until he gets into the presidency. So Lincoln is anti-slavery, but he's not an abolitionist. He also believes very strongly that from a constitutional perspective, he cannot allow slavery to extend into the West, but he doesn't believe he has the right to take it down where it now exists. So I hope that's clear for everybody. I also want you to understand, so this would be the third thing about Lincoln that I think is necessary to understand. He is not pro-black until 1863. So simply because he doesn't believe in slavery does not make him in some way a believer in equality between blacks and whites. So that's also something that we often like to project on those who were against slavery, but he was very skeptical about the possibility of blacks ever being able to live on an equal basis with whites. And this is why his solution, though, yeah, what's he going to do about it before he's president, his solution was always one of recolonization up until about 1863. You'll notice I brought that year up a number of times. It's a key year for him. But really, up until 1863, he thinks the only possibility of ending slavery is by buying slaves or through law, making them free, but then moving them elsewhere. Now, the possibilities were somewhat endless. You could move them back to Africa. Lincoln thought that would be way too expensive, and his proposal generally was to buy a chunk of Central America. That was a very common proposal in his day. that you would buy a huge piece of Nicaragua and in Honduras, and that's where you would probably resettle blacks. So that would be a lot cheaper than actually creating an African colony in Africa. And there were all kinds of worries too, and this was part of, it's hard to say it's racism, it's probably more cultural bias than it is actual racism, but there was also this belief that if you sent blacks back to Africa, that they would devolve back into savagery and they would lose their Christianity. So if you wanted to maintain Christianity, it would be better to put them in the New World than in the Old World. So these are not ways we talk, and it's uncomfortable to talk about this, but I want you to understand how they were thinking about this. So I'm going to read to you just briefly from the Lincoln-Douglas debates. And these, of course, are... So if you remember, as we talked about, Lincoln is the great eminence behind all the major political movements of the 1850s, at least those that will be tending towards abolition. So even though he's not an abolitionist, he's playing a very serious role between 1854 and 1860 as the guy behind the scenes, writing speeches, giving advice, giving debate points. This is how you should answer this. This, if you're interviewed by the paper, this is what you should say. And then, amazingly enough, and how, this is where, whether or not you want to call this just coincidence or providence, as a historian, I can't judge that. But certainly there are things here that seem like they are providential. Stephen Douglas is going to run, of course, for the Senate in 1858, and there's no way he'll lose, none. There's no chance at all that he's going to lose. Everybody knows that he'll win the Senate seat. So Lincoln is run by the Republicans and the Whigs to oppose Stephen Douglas in Illinois. And it's not even a long shot. It's no possibility. Anybody who takes that position, who runs against Douglas, is a sacrificial lamb. That's all that person is. And everybody knows that. So Lincoln volunteers to be this person. And the reason that he does so is because he wants to test out, and this is a trial run for him, he wants to test out his arguments he's been working on since 1854 and see how they actually play out in the political field. This will allow him not to go into politics, but to maintain his status as the great eminence and to allow him to continue to have some kind of effect and at least some kind of special charisma, some kind of influence on other peoples who are actually viable for office. Lincoln doesn't see himself as such. So 1858 is the real test. Are these ideas viable in the actual political arena? It's one thing for him to sit behind his desk and write his diary and write speeches in the abstract, but what happens when he encounters someone who's against him? Now, Douglas himself is an interesting figure. Remember, he'd obviously been one of the suitors for Lincoln's wife. But more importantly, for our purposes, he had become probably the leading spokesman for the Democratic movement. And I don't just mean Democratic Party. I'm talking small d, Democratic movement in the 1850s. He was a nationalist. He was never, ever either really pro-slavery or really anti-slavery. So we often think, again, our myth is kind of Lincoln was anti-slavery, Douglas was pro-slavery. You can't do that, because even though Douglas tends towards allowing slavery, that is not his primary issue. He is a hardcore nationalist. He would be what we would call a neocon today. And what he wanted was a solidification of the country, especially east to west, so that we could project power abroad. Slavery was a very unfortunate distraction for Stephen Douglas. That's how he saw it. He's not concerned about freeing black people. He's also not concerned about oppressing them. That's not his goal. His goal is to get the country unified so that we can project power elsewhere. And he was a member of the Democratic Party, but he always referred to himself not as a Democrat, but as a young American. That was the young American moniker, was the idea that America had to get its act together in order to promote democracy around the world. And we would export it everywhere. And Douglas was always, he always had schemes. Okay, Hungary's going in revolt. How do we smuggle arms to them? Do we send advisors to them? Do we go over and train them? We teach them guerrilla tactics. Could we even hire American Indians to go over to Europe and to teach Europeans how to fight in a guerrilla way? This is what Douglas is thinking, and it's his prime motivation. So when Lincoln is willing to challenge this, when Lincoln is willing to be the scapegoat, the sacrificial lamb on the other side, he wants Douglas to talk about slavery. That's what he's trying to do. His goal is to get Douglas to show his weaknesses. Again, Lincoln never thinks he's going to win. He may win the debates. He'll never win the election. So he knows that. So his goal is to bring these issues up and to test what he's been working on. Lincoln, of course, has his own nationalist streak, but that's not going to arise until he's president. Lincoln is not a nationalist up to that point, in the sense that Douglas is. Lincoln is actually very, very isolationist, if we want to put 1950s terms on him. He's much more of America take care of our own business and let the rest of the world worry about itself. He's not like Douglas wanting to project power abroad. He wants to take care of things at home. And he is very concerned about how slavery will develop in the West. But again, not strictly because he doesn't believe slavery is wrong. He does. But it's also because Lincoln does not want black people in the West. That's also a very important thing for him, that he will not spread slavery into the West, not simply because it's slavery, but because he would also be promoting the black race there. Now, Lincoln's not totally against the black race. He just doesn't want them propagating in Western soil. The West is meant to be for white people, as he sees it. And I want to stress this again, because you probably come across this in Potter, and you may have been a little confused by it, and understandably, when the Republicans run in certain areas in 1856, often they call themselves the Republican Party. That's always in the fine print. But quite often, in 1856 as well as 1860, they run as the White Man's Party. And that is intentional on their part. Again, so don't ever make synonymous Republican and abolitionists. The abolitionists find their home in the Republican Party, just like Rand Paul finds his home in the Republican Party. But obviously the Republican Party is not libertarian, and the same thing was exactly true in the 1850s. The party is not abolitionists. It's just where the abolitionists can find at least a home to a certain degree. So here's Lincoln, very importantly, during the Lincoln-Douglas debates. Now, the great mistake Douglas makes, and yet I kind of credit him for this as well, Douglas never had to debate Lincoln. He could have easily just said no. It would have cost him nothing. In fact, Douglas can only lose by accepting Lincoln's challenge. And Lincoln is really, in a funny way, he's really obnoxious about it. So when Douglas is still deciding if he's going to debate Lincoln formally or not during the Lincoln-Douglas debates, Lincoln follows him everywhere. He follows him into church. He'll follow him into business meetings. And he stalks him. There's no question. Lincoln is stalking Douglas. And every time Douglas is asked a question, Lincoln is there ready to give a response in order to promote his view as well. And finally, Douglas, they all know each other. Illinois is not that big. They all know each other. And of course, they pursued somewhat the same woman. So there's a lot of interconnections there. And finally, Douglas agrees. Let's just get this thing in the open and we'll have these debates. So, but Douglas can only lose by this, right? It's basically, this is an annoyance. He can only come down. There's no way he can gain any respectability anywhere by having these debates with Lincoln. They're worthless for him, but it's kind of cool that he accepts them. In large part, he thinks he can probably win, but he knows he's gonna win the vote no matter what. So he's in that position. Okay, so here's Lincoln in the very first debate. And I know we might have a debate about this if we had the historians or the political scientists in here about this, but I'm going to put it this way. I've had rigorous debates with students in this class before about this, rigorous and vigorous about this, but I pretty much assume from my study of Lincoln that Lincoln never says anything he doesn't believe. And that's a lot of people will try and interpret Lincoln as we have to read between the lines. That is, that he only tells us what he thinks is politically viable to say but there's a kind of undercurrent. You are welcome to believe that if you want. I can't force you to believe one way or another. But from my study of LinkedIn, my study shows that LinkedIn is unbelievably honest. If he says a thing, he means it. And he may contradict himself, but he's not an ideologue. He's not crazy. Yet really only crazy people are totally consistent in all things, except for Jesus, obviously. But here, I mean, we're really, and Lincoln understands me. Lincoln makes some mistakes. There's no doubt about that. But don't try and think of him, at least for this class, as a master manipulator trying to deceive people. That is not how I see Lincoln. Lincoln is straightforward when he says something. So here's what he says in the very first debate with Douglas. This is August 21st at Ottawa. Ottawa is in kind of central southern Illinois. And so that means, I hope you guys realize, the population of Illinois is very split. Northern Illinois, to this day, is much more cosmopolitan, intermixed, urban. Southern Illinois is essentially all what they would have called crackers or Hoosiers or butternuts, basically poor whites. So Lincoln's going to have to vary his message a little bit north to south. But we could probably put too much on that as well. But now he's in Ottawa, so he's in the poor white area when he says this. And Douglas has accused Lincoln of being pro-black. Right? He's a black lover. That's one of the worst things you could ever say. And from at least the standpoint of many people in America in the 1850s, he's a lover of blacks. So this is how Lincoln responds. I don't want to read at any greater length, but this is the true complexion of all I have ever said in regard to the institution of slavery and the black race. So Lincoln throws down the gauntlet. You can say whatever you want about me, you can make up anything, but frankly, this is it. And of course, remember, there are reporters from all over the country here watching this. Lincoln-Douglas debates were the most serious debates after the Webster-Hayne debates two and a half decades earlier. A decade and a half earlier. This is the major debate of the 19th century. This is the whole of it, and anything that argues me into an idea of perfect social and political equality with the Negro is but a specious and fantastic arrangement of words by which a man can prove a horse chestnut to be a chestnut-colored horse. So don't read into this, right? Lincoln says. I'm going to state it flat out. This is what I believe. Don't make anything other of it than what I said. I will say here, while upon this subject, that I have no purpose, directly or indirectly, to interfere with the institution of slavery in the states where it exists. Now, that is also undeniable. Lincoln never once challenges the idea of slavery in the states where it now exists. Not once does he ever believe that he can take that down. In fact, as many of you may know, the very first thing he proposes when he becomes president of the United States is the passage of the 13th Amendment, which is not at all the 13th Amendment we have now. It is exactly the opposite. The 13th Amendment, as it was proposed in 1861, was the language Lincoln just used, that the Constitution and those who support the Constitution will never strike down slavery where it now exists. That was the original 13th Amendment, and Lincoln openly endorses it in 1861. So that we see that all the way through his first year of the presidency. He does not believe he can interfere with slavery where it now exists. So I believe I have no lawful right to do so, and I have no inclination to do so. I have no purpose to introduce political and social equality between the white and the black races. There is a physical difference between the two, which in my judgment will probably forever forbid their living together upon footing of perfect equality. And inasmuch as it becomes a necessity that there must be a difference, I, just as Judge Douglas — Douglas had been a justice before he was a senator — I, as well as Judge Douglas, am in favor of the race to which I belong, holding the superior position. You just can't argue with that. Lincoln has laid it out. Whites are superior to blacks. That will almost always be the case, Lincoln says. I have never said anything to the contrary, but I hold that notwithstanding all of this. Now, here, this is a critical caveat. So notwithstanding all of this, there is no reason in the world why the Negro is not entitled to all the natural rights enumerated in the Declaration of Independence, the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Okay, that's where it gets really tricky. So blacks will never be politically or socially equal to whites. But when it comes to their natural rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, they're absolute equals. That's where it gets really sticky. What does Lincoln mean by that? How can we have an equality of natural rights if there is no social or political equality? And he goes on to explain what he means by this. And this is straight out of Locke in the way that he explains this. This is right out of John Locke's second treatise. I hold that the black man is as much entitled to these as the white man. I agree with Judge Douglas. He is not my equal in many respects. Certainly, he is not my equal in color, and perhaps not in moral or intellectual endowment. Right? So once again, for Lincoln, blacks are not equal in color, moral, or intellectual endowment. We've also seen, he's already said, they're not politically or socially equal. But in the right to eat the bread without the leave of anybody else, which his own hand has earned, he is my equal and the equal of Judge Douglas and the equal of every living man. Now, once again, this is vital to understand Lincoln. Natural rights for Lincoln are not, at this point, metaphysical. They are material. So if you labor, it does not matter if you are black, white, Hispanic, Asian. Whatever you labor for, the product you create is yours. And in that sense, Lincoln is a strict materialist. That should not surprise us given his own religious views at all, or lack thereof. He is a strict materialist, and he is also, and this is something that Alan Guelzo has done a great job of researching over the last decade. We know that when Lincoln put himself in an intellectual position, he saw himself as the American version of an English utilitarian. So he believed he was America's version of Jeremy Bentham or John Stuart Mill. So that's how he sees himself. And he corresponded, he wrote in the 50s, he corresponded with all the great English utilitarian philosophers. And so that makes sense when we consider what he's saying. So in the right to produce our own work, in the right to mix our labor with the soil, every race is equal. But when it comes to everything else, there are gross inequalities there. So I think that's Lincoln's position, pretty straightforward. There will never be real equality between blacks and whites, but there will always be full equality when it comes to you having the right to the produce of your labor. All right, is this clear for everybody? And feel free to disagree, feel free to ask questions, but I want to make sure that you at least understand how Lincoln is presenting this at this point. And I know you probably all have copies of the Lincoln Douglas debates, but I'm also happy to send this to you, this quote, because here I think Lincoln is really, really throwing down exactly what he means. So if there's not a question, I want to jump forward to a further point where we're now moving up towards the less poor white areas. And in particular, in the last debate, in the seventh debate, we're now in Alton, Illinois. And I want to read to you a couple of quotes from that as well. So one of the things that people have tried to argue, and I think they're ineffective at it, but they've tried to argue that Lincoln really presented several sides, one when he was in southern Illinois and one when he was in northern. But I think he's actually quite consistent. There's no doubt that he tempers his language. He's willing to say things like blacks are not equal openly when he's in southern Illinois. He says the same thing, but in more polite terms, when he's in northern Illinois. But I don't think he's arguing necessarily different things. When he is pushed, and this is his final speech, so October 15th now, when he is pushed, and Douglas, of course, is going to keep pushing Lincoln no matter what, I want you to tell me what you think about equality with blacks. Lincoln says, and especially after it's known that the Republicans have been running as the white man's party, this is what he says. This is Lincoln. again, October 15th is final debate, the seventh debate, Lincoln-Douglas debates. Irrespective of the moral aspect of the question as to whether there is a right or wrong in enslaving the Negro, I am still in favor of our new territories being in such a condition that white men may find a home, that white men may find a spot where they can better their condition and where white men can settle upon new soil and better their condition in life. It's pretty clear. Right? Now, he hasn't said exclusively that he doesn't want blacks out there, but you can read, I think, pretty clearly that this is what he's getting at. And then he says, I am in favor of this not merely, as I must say here, but I have said elsewhere, for our own people who are born amongst us, but as an outlet for every free white people the world over, in which every man named Hans, Baptiste, or Patrick may find new homes to better their condition in life. Notice he doesn't say Hans, Baptiste, and Mugabe. There are no African names there. He is giving us peasant names of whites. And he seems pretty clear about that, that this is what he's going for. And then he says, right before that in the same speech, I think the authors of that notable instrument, the Declaration, intended to include all men, but they never meant to declare all men equal in all respects. They did not mean to say that all men were equal in color, size, intellect, moral development, or social capacity. They defined with tolerable distinctness in what they did consider all men being created equal. Equal in terms of certain inalienable rights, among which are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. This they said, and this they meant. They did not mean to assert the obvious untruth that all were then actually enjoying equality, or yet that they were about to confer it immediately upon them. In fact, they had no power to confer such a boon. They might simply mean to declare the right so that the enforcement of it might follow as fast as circumstances would permit. So even for Lincoln, all men are created equal does not mean all men are equal. It means that they all have equal access to the fruits of their labor. So that's Lincoln's view, and it is an extremely materialist, very utilitarian view with almost no metaphysics. Yeah.
Is Lincoln saying that the founders themselves shared his more materialistic utilitarianism?
On that issue. They may not have on other things, but on that issue in particular, the founders were not being metaphysicians. They were not being philosophers. They were stating a physical truth that anyone who labors has the right to the fruit of their own labor. So on that issue, right, that's what Lincoln's saying. And Lincoln does. Now, let me say two things about this, because I think this is really important. Lincoln's going to change his mind. Right, so I don't want you to leave Lincoln here. Lincoln is going to change his mind dramatically, and it's going to be one of the most important moments, not just in American history, but in world history. Lincoln comes to realize in 1863, we'll talk a lot about this, believe me, you'll probably be sick of it by the time the semester's over, but when Lincoln decides in 1863 that the only way for blacks to show their equality is by arming them, that changes the whole world. And once Lincoln arms blacks and they perform very well, in fact, in terms of statistics, slightly better than whites do on the battlefield, Lincoln's entire attitude towards blacks changes, and so do many Americans. The fact that the 54th and 55th Massachusetts regiments, which were all black regiments, rush into battle is enough proof for almost anyone who was on the sidelines. It was enough proof that blacks were equal to whites. That's what it was going to take. But it's going to take a bit for Lincoln to get there. And of course, you can imagine, if Lincoln truly does believe that blacks are not the moral or intellectual equivalent to whites, what's going to happen if he arms them and then the first regiment armed runs away? That would be the ultimate disaster for black rights in America. The ultimate disaster. And that was a possibility, at least this is Lincoln's fear. So when he arms blacks, he does it through Governor Andrews of Massachusetts. But when he does it, this is one of the greatest experiments and really the greatest gambles that any person has ever taken in political history. It's a major moment. So, Sam.
Was the reasoning behind that like the kind of the old school view that you weren't a man unless you were willing to fight
for
freedom?
There's no such thing as manhood unless you're willing to die for your beliefs. Absolutely. That's everything. And that's where I think we have to be careful, because Lincoln will move from a purely materialistic view to an utterly metaphysical view, because that can be none more metaphysical, right? Folks finding that. It just can't. It can't get any better than that. You are then in full Republican mode in terms of an aristocratic soul. Absolutely. So that's going to change a lot. Okay, any other questions on this? We're going to come back to this, but I want you to understand this is, it's not the majority opinion in the North, it's the growing minority opinion that will then gain power. So when Lincoln comes to the presidency, he is going to be taking these thoughts into the White House and therefore into the Union and into the Civil War. So that evolution of his thought is dramatic. No evolution on his constitutional means. Right? The only reason Lincoln says during the war itself that he has the right to interfere with slavery where it now exists is because those states have gone into rebellion. If they had not gone into rebellion, Lincoln would have no right to get rid of slavery. He can only get rid of slavery because they've gone into rebellion. So he will change to a certain degree how he applies the rule, but that rule remains consistent, that constitutional idea. But he will move from a physical to a metaphysical understanding of this, moving into it. Okay, so let me get the other side then. Thanks for the questions. So let me get to the other side and try and explain how the South is thinking of this. Very, very few people in the South are adamantly pro-slavery. You're going to find, because those who are adamantly pro-slavery are the wealthy and the educated, you're going to have an exaggerated view of slavery as somewhat of a good thing. But if you remember, as of 1820, with the Missouri Compromise, there is no such thing as slavery as a positive good. Nobody talks in that language. There is no positive good language being used for slavery. That does not exist in the 1820s at all. Missouri Compromise has nothing to do with that. It will not change it. It will maybe move things a little bit forward, but there's no such language as that. The first time that we'll ever see the idea of slavery as a positive good, not a necessary evil, will be in the late 1830s. At that point, you'll start seeing this language in which people in the South, especially the elites, will begin to think, yes, this is not just something we have to do, but it's actually a good. We take these people out of Africa, where they would have been cannibals, or they would have been savages. We bring them to America, we Christianize them, and yes, we work them all day, but at the end of the day, they can go home and be with their family and their kids, and they have food and housing provided. So this is the positive good argument. But that positive good is still a very rare idea. We won't see it fully develop in the South. So we'll start seeing the first mention in the late 1830s. But the first time we'll see any consistent argument in favor of a positive good will be in a book that's published, and you guys had to read a selection of this, from 1853-54 by a guy named George Fitzhugh. You had to read this in Heritage, Sociology of the South. Right? That is the first time we'll have a consistent argument in favor of positive good. So 1854 is really the time, the year in which this becomes not something debatable, but now an almost absolute truth in the South. And you can trace, by the way, newspapers do this, and we don't have a lot of other ways to note it, but you can see between about 1854 and 1857, nobody in the South will talk any more at all about slavery as being embarrassing. They will only speak of it in the language of it being a positive good. Now, here's the fascinating thing. You guys remember, I tried to tie this to abortion right at the beginning of the class. You know, think about, and I realize I'm older, and Kathy and I, we're a little older than you guys, so we've got, you know, we've seen some of the way this has developed. Of course, I was five, four, when Roe v. Wade was passed, so I don't really remember that very well. But we can see how this transitions. You know, think about abortion. It's gone where the supporters of it, you always have a radical few, of course, as early as the late 1960s with Gloria Steinem. You'll always have a few who are kind of celebrating it. But the idea that you would have over the last year and a half people addressing genitalia and promoting this as a good and celebrating, you know, actually lighting up towers in New York for the death of babies. I mean, that has radicalized so dramatically just in the last 2-3 years. That's exactly what happens with this in the positive good argument. So we'll start seeing it become the norm by 1853-54. By 1857, you're really not allowed in the South to make any other argument. It would be unacceptable. Then in 1860, and this is the Twin Towers moment, in 1860, the Democrats put in their platform that slavery is not just a positive good for the South. The country as a whole must recognize it as a positive good. That's how radical this becomes. But don't ever think, which I think we often do, that the South always believed that. It's not true. There's a long, slow evolution towards that. But as we'll see, the idea becomes radical, then it becomes the norm, then it becomes not just the norm, but it becomes the only thing you can say by 1860. So that's the trajectory of all of this with that positive good. But I also want to stress, and I think, you know, people like Dr. Kaltoff have done amazing work on this, that you can only make this argument once you have scientific, and it's not really scientific, it's scientism, but once you start having scientific arguments about race and evolution. So it would not have been possible, for example, for John C. Calhoun in 1820 to be a full-blown racist, but by 1850, he's a full-blown racist. And in large part because it's very hard to make that argument. So I think I may have mentioned before, but other great scholars like Robert Nisbet have shown in his own sociology that the idea of race in terms of skin color or biology really did not exist in the ancient world in any way that we would recognize.
I know Fitzhugh said that, like, I think it was Fitzhugh said that every society needs to enslave a certain caste of people. It's like the North should enslave the Irish or something like that. So yes. Was it just more of like a, not, no, it doesn't matter that it's black, it could be the whites up there, but like you need those people. Was he just really, really idiosyncratic in that? Or?
Well, yeah, and I've actually, this is something that we've been talking about in the history department quite a bit, and over the last week especially. So it is funny you asked that, Sammy. I spent the last week since I saw you guys last, since Thursday, I read both of Fitzhugh's books. So I read Sociology of the South and Cannibal's Almonds. I will freely admit that as a scholar of the 19th century, it's pretty bad that I'm 51 and I've never read the whole things before. So I can finally say I've read them all. And they're really the same book. And so these were his two big books, one, Sociology of the South, and then Cannibal's Almonds. They basically are the exact same book, rearranged in different ways. But he does make that argument. So his argument, if you don't mind, I'm gonna quote from this because, well, let me give this a little bit of background. Sammy's question is a perfect question, but let me give just a tiny bit of background. In the South, we have really three great intellectuals over time, and I'm actually going to give you five, but we have three in particular who kind of, we at least, people in the South as well as historians looking back will identify them as the most important thinkers of their time period. There's always opposition, of course. That I don't mean to suggest it's monolithic, but we have originally John Randolph of Roanoke. So we have Randolph, one of the quirkiest guys who's ever lived in America, certainly. But Randolph is kind of the early fountainhead of the South. And then we move to Calhoun. And after Calhoun, remember Calhoun passes away in 1851. After Calhoun, it's Jeff Davis. But there are two other figures who matter. So these guys are really the fountainheads of Southern thinking, or the touchstones, however you want to put it. But there are two other guys who matter here as well. One, at the time of Randolph, would be more of the kind of moderate Federalist vision. And we don't talk about him much in this class, but if you take Revolution, you'll learn a lot about him. Charles Carroll Carrollton, who would be a much more moderate, and I'll come back to why he's important, a much more moderate thinker. But in between Davis and Calhoun, as Sammy just asked, you have Fitzhugh. And Fitzhugh is, as Sammy said, pretty odd in a lot of ways. And one of the things we've been debating in the history department, especially since we've got a part of his document in the reader, is just how influential was he. And so that's actually a for better or worse, have spent the last really digging into how influential he was. And it seems to be the case that almost everybody in the South agreed to either agree or disagree with him. He was one of those figures that basically everybody recognized was the best mind, even if they disagreed with him. So you'll see that he becomes, during the Civil War, he becomes a member of the Treasury Department in the Confederacy. And then after the Civil War, he's such a powerful figure that the Republicans bring him in as a judge in the Freedmen's Bureau. So, and he himself, and this is where I was thinking about this positive good argument, he himself argues in the second book, so again, sorry if I'm going too fast, but 53 is Sociology of the South, and then 57 is Cannibals All. He argues in Cannibals All that, and I think he's giving himself too much credit, but it's not an outright just claim. He says that the whole reason by 1857 nobody talks of slavery as anything other than a positive good is because of the influence of his first book. Now, that's pretty cocky, but it seems to be somewhat true. Now, here's what's fascinating about this, at least for me. So if you look at this trajectory, and some of you may remember Randolph and Carroll from earlier classes, but Randolph and Carroll had both believed that slavery was absolutely a necessary evil. Neither of them would have ever argued it was a good in any way. And in fact, they spent much of their careers, both of them. Yeah, Carroll was the second in charge of the American Recolonization Society after Bushrod Washington. And both Carroll and Randolph free all of their slaves, of course, towards the end of their lives. But they are doing everything possible to figure out how to free slavery and get rid of this institution. By the time you get to Calhoun, and I'll talk more about him as well, but by the time you get to Calhoun, Calhoun starts off much more like these guys, saying it's really embarrassing to, by the late 1840s, really believing he's a great slaveholder and that this is a good thing. So he's that transition figure, but then when you get to Fitzhugh and Davis, they think absolutely this is a good. So Davis's problem, and it's the opposite of Fitzhugh. Davis is a really nice guy, I'll just put it that way. Now, I think he makes some serious moral mistakes during the war, as we'll see. But he is a truly nice guy. The problem is, he is really smart at certain things. He has no imagination. So Davis's real problem throughout all the 1850s and 60s is that he had always treated his slaves. In fact, slaves, blacks in the South, referred to his plantation as Happy Paradise. That was the black name for his plantation. Yeah, it wasn't hell, it wasn't this level of the inferno, it was Happy Paradise. And Davis never in his life would have used corporal punishment or in any way abused the slave. Here's his problem, that's great. As a moral character, moral aspect to Davis, it's fantastic. But here's his problem. He could never imagine anybody mistreating a slave because he never would, and his parents never would. So he always grows up thinking all slavery is this kindly way of treating people, and it's really more of a family than anything else. Fitzhugh, on the other hand, has imagination galore, and for better or worse. Fitzhugh does believe that slavery could be bad, but it also can work out well. So here's what I'm going to read to you for today from Fitzhugh. So I'm going to read from Sociology for the South. This is not the part you guys had. It's a pretty big book, actually. You just had a few pages from it. But this is elsewhere. So if we want to understand Fitzhugh, and this is why I don't want you to say that all of the South is Fitzhugh, but Fitzhugh definitely represents the greatest mind of the South, even if I think almost every single one of us in this room will despise his thought. And partly we're going to despise his thought, not just because he's anti-black, but, and this is one of the things that's incredible, he's a Marxist, and he's very open about that. He loves Marx, and he's been reading Marx, and he's been reading all of the socialists of the 1840s and 1850s. Now, when he publishes these works in 1853 and 57, obviously he doesn't have access to Das Kapital. That won't even be published until 1871. So he's reading the early Marx, not the later Marx. But he has also read, his favorite thinker that he quotes all the time is, and I'm sorry, I can't pronounce the name very well, but Proudhon, who later became an anarchist, but was originally one of the great socialists. That's who he really, really likes. And so he is very tied in with these early socialists. And the subtitle of his book is Slavery as Socialism. It's a very positive thing. So he argues, I'll read to you, but he argues that all free society is chaotic society. And therefore, if you want instability, you should be a libertarian. That's, if you want instability, that's what you go for. In fact, he has this whole history showing that only ignorant savages, whether they're Germans or Indians or Africans, only ignorant savages like freedom. Anyone who's civilized at all loves authority. That is his argument. So this is the distinction between a savage society in which there's freedom and a civilized society in which there's always authority, and serious authority, not just, you know, Billy Bob over there telling us how we should act, but what we should think as well. Right? That's part of it. Here's what he says. The free laborer rarely has a house and a home of his own. He is insecure of employment. Sickness may overtake him at any time and deprive him of the means of support. Old age is certain to overtake him if he lives, and generally he finds himself without the means of subsistence once he is aged. His family is probably increasing in number, and he is helpless and burdensome to them. In all this, there is little to no incentive to virtue. Even there is much temptation to crime, nothing that could ever be happiness, but quite enough to inflict misery. Man must be more than human to acquire a pure and high morality under such circumstances. For what is free society? Free society is that in which the sentiments, the principles, the feelings, and the affections of the high and low, the rich and the poor, are blunted and debased, always in a continual warfare of competition. Free society begets rivalries, jealousies, and hatreds. It always leads, he doesn't use this term, but it always leads to entropy. So all free society is chaos. That's all it is, in every way. And it's primitive. But then he turns this around, and he says, well, what do we want then? Why is slavery so perfect? Liberty places those classes in positions of antagonism and war. Slavery, instead, identifies the interests of both rich and poor, master and servant, and begets domestic affection on one side and loyalty and respect on the other. Slavery produces the truest association of labor, and whether we want to call slavery communism or socialism, this is what all communists and socialists desire. A well-conducted plantation in the South is the model of associated labor that any European socialist would envy. One old woman nurses all the children whilst the mothers are at work. Another old woman waits on the sick in a house set aside for them. Another old woman washes and cooks, and a fourth makes mends in the clothing. This is the greatest economy of labor and the greatest idea that the socialists have ever understood. Slavery protects all infants, the aged, and the sick. Nay, it takes better care of them than of the healthy, the middle-aged, and the strong. Instead, the weak and the poor are as much a part of a family in socialism and slavery, and self-interest and domesticated affection continue to shelter, shield, and foster one another. A man loves not only his horses and his cattle, which are useful to him, but he loves his dog, which is of no use. He loves them because they are his. He is their master. What a wise and beneficent provision of heaven that makes the selflessness of man's nature a protecting shield to defend his wife and children, his slaves, and even his dumb animals. The socialists propose to reach this result, but they never can if they do not understand that the only road Providence has given us for true socialism is the plantation. Right? So this is what he's arguing. Right? Socialism is perfected in the southern plantation. This is where you have the absolute communist or socialistic society. That's amazing to think about that. Now, I don't want to suggest that we're now in a war between northern free labor and southern commies, right? You can imagine Berzer says Confederates are commies, right? That's not what I'm getting at. But there's no doubt that that thinking is pervading much of the South. So once again, and I hate to just keep beating on this, and yet I don't hate it, that when we typically think of the South as libertarian and the North as authoritarian, we're just dead wrong. It's just not here. It does not exist. That does not play out. That is one of the greatest myths to arise after the Civil War, but the evidence does not in any way lend itself towards that. So we'll forget Fitzhugh for a moment, but I do want us to think about the Southern slave structure and the structure of society itself. So in the North, prior to the Civil War, it would be pretty near impossible to find any serious class divisions in a way that we would recognize today. And by the way, I hope you guys, if you get a chance, I don't think I'm going to be able to go, unfortunately, but if you can go to Charles Murray's talk today, you should most certainly go. He's not as big a deal today as he would have been when I was your age, but he's an incredible thinker. He's certainly one of our greatest thinkers, and he's written a lot on class society and what class does. So if you can see him, I think it's over in Dow A and B at 5. Do I have that right? Does anyone know? But it would be, this would, you would kick yourself. He's an older guy, and if he passes away and you miss the opportunity to see him, I think you'd be really regretful. So if you can go, you should go. Even though I'm saying and not doing, I've seen him speak several times, but you should go see him. And I think about him because we're talking about class, and Murray's great argument today is that because of what he calls the bell curve, which has very little to do with race, but everything to do with class, it tends to be the case, he argues. Now, he may be wrong, but he argues that almost always intelligent people marry intelligent people. Unintelligent people or lesser intelligent people, however, I don't know why you're supposed to say that today, but however, people who are not as interested in the life of the mind tend to marry or not marry, they associate or shack up with people who are not as interested in the life of the mind. And he argues that we've seen this great division in American society over 30 years in which the educated keep isolating themselves from everybody else. And educated isn't necessarily good. It's more, it's not a true education, but it's a kind of false how to survive in society. If we take that kind of class analysis and we put it back on America in the 19th century, at least prior to the Civil War, there's almost no class structure in the North. There are a lot of reasons for this. Partly because the North is expanding so fast. Labor is in such demand. This is one of the greatest economic points of the 19th century. We never have enough labor in America in the 19th century, ever. We are always in a labor shortage. It's 100 years of labor shortage. And that means that laborers are always, free laborers, are treated better here than anywhere in the world. They make close to 10 times the wages in America that they can make in Europe at the same time. And our economy is just booming to such a degree that we don't have those serious class divisions. Now, after the Civil War, we'll have huge class divisions in the North. You'll start seeing a wealthy class that uses laws to protect itself, especially corporation laws. Corporation laws were first passed during the Civil War in order to allow for businesses to avoid liability. And that would change the entire structure of the U.S. economy because it benefits capital without question. But prior to that, you don't have those laws. So basically, every mom and pop store was competing with any corporation on an equal foot because being a corporation didn't give you the advantages prior to the Civil War that it does now. So the great distinctive in the North prior to the Civil War, what determined if someone was upper class or lower class, was not economics, but education. So prior to the Civil War, how educated you were was basically how high you were in society. So what John Quincy Adams, who has hardly any money and never did it, can be upper crust because he is deeply liberally educated. Whereas a George Washington, who cannot be upper crust because of his education, can make it so through his actions in the military. Those are really the only two routes to being high up. Either one, having served in the military as an officer, you can't do it as an enlisted person, but as an officer, especially in the Navy, this is how James Fenimore Cooper became upper class, but it was either education or military service. it was not economic status. So it's very possible to be wealthy in the North and have no status at all because you don't have education. In the South, though, it's quite different. In the South, we can identify five distinct classes, economic, socioeconomic, and educational classes, five of them total. So number one is the smallest by far, but these are the Southern elite. So in the South, the first and highest of all classes are the plantation owners. And always, and I hope you guys know this, maybe this should be clear, always this means a man, right? Always. There's no such thing as an elite woman in being able to control lots of things. You might have an exception like Mary Chestnut, who is extremely influential because of her charisma, but you're not going to have her as a ruler of society. Her husband will be Senator Chestnut, but she will be always kind of an accessory. So the plantation class is by far the most powerful, and it depends where you're at. In certain states, they hold almost all power. In South Carolina, you literally have about 1%, I know I'm sounding like an Occupy Wall Street radical, but it was just the case at the time. You literally have about 1% of the people ruling everybody else. And if that 1% decides that you can or can't do something, that's the way it's going to go. So in a place like South Carolina, which is the most extreme by far, you know, imagine what happens for those of you who took Jacksonian. Remember what happens when Calhoun leaves his position as vice president. Within days, he's now senator of South Carolina. But of course, everybody gets moved around. He goes from being vice president to being senator of South Carolina. That senator, whose place he took, is given the governorship. And that governor then is just given money to kind of go off and do his own thing. That's power. If you, within a few days, can just move around your politicians any way you want, that's immense power. That was Calhoun's power, and certainly what we see in a place like South Carolina. In other places like Louisiana or Mississippi, you're going to have much more diversified control. You may have an elite that's 10% of the population as opposed to 1%. So it's going to depend on where you are and what part of the South. But the plantation class, at best in the South, probably never represented more than 2% of the population anywhere in the South. So whereas in the North, you're going to have a relatively classless society, in the South, you're going to have it divided so that a very small percentage of people control everything. What do they have? Well, two very distinguishing things, and this is, of course, all patriarchal. The two very distinguishing things here for these plantation owners. Number one, they will always be liberally or classically educated. Always. So this is, you guys remember reading, of course, that scoundrel, William Byrd, in Heritage Class, the only R-rated document that you had in there. He was kind of a perfect example. If you remember, he knew Greek, he knew Latin, and he was studying Italian on the side so that he could read Dante in the original. Very liberally educated. So that's one of the distinguishing factors. The other one is that you're always a slave owner. And generally, these people in the top 2% would own anywhere from about 100 to about 500 slaves, sometimes as many as 800. But that's super, super wealthy. But generally, between about 100 and 500. So these are huge plantations in which this is developing. Then you have class number two, and these would be what we would call the middle-class whites. They're not the crackers or the Hoosiers. They're something different. These are basically, probably, if we were living in the South, this would be most of us, right? This kind of middle-class white, people who are semi-professional, maybe in law, maybe in building construction, maybe farming. Farming is still the most prevalent thing to do. So in this middle class, you would aspire, generally, depending on your politics, but you would aspire maybe to own one slave, maybe two. And these slaves would always be intimately related to you in some way. So you wouldn't own a slave if you just had one and send them out to do all the work. Usually the slave would work kind of like maybe a hired woman coming in, doing the cleaning, the laundry, taking care of the children. So it's not a great life, but it's not a terrible life either, especially compared to these 100 to 500 who become anonymous cattle, essentially, working out in the field. It's a lot different. But when we're talking about the middle class owning a slave, if the middle class makes up maybe 50% of Southern whites, maybe one out of every 10 families could afford one slave. So, and that was always a mark of distinction that you were able to, but it's not at this other level where you've got hundreds of slaves. So middle class typically had some liberal education, but usually were either well-to-do farmers or people who went into a profession. Now this is where it gets surprising, and it should be surprising for all of us in the class. According to the class structure of the South, group number three are not the poor whites. Believe it or not, the poorest whites will be the lowest on the social rung in society. Instead, number three are the free blacks, those who have worked their way generally out of slavery, which happened. It wasn't the norm. It did happen, though. And most of these people, though, were those blacks who had never really been enslaved but had been forced indentured servants during the 1600s and were released at the end of 7 years of servitude. So these are those families that had come over originally but had not been permanently enslaved. Now, we're not talking about a lot of people here. We're still talking about maybe a quarter of a million people total in the South. So maybe about 250,000 total in the South. So not huge numbers, pretty small. But in terms of class structure, they'd be number three. Number four would be slaves, black slaves. So here again, we're talking about only a percentage of the population, but a big one now. Not small like the free blacks. Now we're talking about 4 million people out of roughly 12 million people. So we've got roughly a third of the population in the South in this class, in this economic class. So here's where it's surprising. Number five are the lowest, and these are the Hoosiers, the Butternuts, the white trash. So poor whites are regarded, and it's not a big percentage of people, but they are regarded as the lowest of the low. It is better to be a slave in the South. You have more rights as a slave than you do as one of these people at the bottom rung within the class of whites. So these people were just completely, and I don't mean to sound bigoted here, it's just the way they would have been talked about. They were truly white trash. This was trailer trash. These were people who could not get their lives together. And if you think about it logically, there's a sense to it. If you're a white and you're more degraded than a black slave, obviously you're worthless, as they would have seen it. So within the structure, it makes some sense, but it's obviously very brutal. So these are the kinds of people. This is what, at least on Lincoln's father's side, this is what Lincoln comes out of. And that's why Southerners had a very difficult time believing that Thomas Lincoln was really his dad. This is why they kind of projected and said it had to be Henry Clay. It's also why his mother had to have been of nobility, because nobody good comes out of this. Nobody. White trash is as low as it gets, as they saw it. Yeah?
Practically speaking, in what ways did slaves then have more rights than the poor whites?
Right. These guys, so in a slave would actually be given a certain responsibility and there'd be a certain deference to that slave because of what the slave could produce for society. These people were seen as total parasites on society. There was nothing to them. So yeah, if we want to think about, and again, I hate to be so crass about this, but these people would kind of be like the way, not necessarily us in this class, but many Americans, say, would treat homeless in Chicago, where you just kind of walk right by them and give them no credence at all, and feel like if they're asking you for money, that it's a con. Right? It's kind of that feeling. So they always defined that these people were people who did not work the soil at all. So there was no virtue to them. All they did was hunt and fish. So this would not be for you guys, but for Kathy and me in the 70s, these would have been the Appalachian folk. That's kind of changed a little bit with the dirt poor. Or if any of you, if you want to read a great story about this now, yeah, it's horrific, but it's brilliantly written, is I Am Charlotte Simmons. If any of you have written that, read that novel by Tom Wolfe, it's an incredible novel. But it's about a poor white girl who ends up going to Duke, and her whole life is it's brutal, but incredible. So I don't know if that answers you, but those are who these people are. So if one of these people were to walk into town, you know, even a black slave could have walked into a store to buy something for his master, these people would have been turned away. They would not have been allowed into a store or into any reputable aspect of society at all. Yeah.
So socially, obviously, they're worse off than slaves, but excuse me, just to be clear, legally speaking, though, they have more rights than slaves.
Yes, but
like in court.
They would in court. Yes, that's absolutely true. They would in court. But they generally wouldn't be allowed into court, and probably because they were not literate at all. These people are almost completely illiterate. And you know, so the ability to be able to testify would have been seen as very suspect.
And were they disenfranchised in most of these cases?
Oh, okay. Nobody's going to let these guys vote. No way. And nor would they, they're probably not even thinking about it either. And most of them are really on the outs of Scotch-Irish society. So these generally aren't poor Anglo-Saxons. These typically are poor Scotch and really who've lost their clan and really only care about whatever's going on immediately around them. But yeah, there are a lot of names we can use for them, and there are gradations within it that, again, Hoosier, Butternut, Buckeye, those almost any of those names that we use for the southern parts of southern Indiana, southern Ohio, those are all considered basically white trash in all kinds of ways, at least at the time. So, yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about the presence of black slave owners?
There are, so the question is, I don't know if you guys all heard, but the question is, what about, where did black slave owners fit into this? There were a number of blacks, but again, we're talking a really small percentage. They were there, but there were blacks who owned other blacks, and they would have been considered still in the third class, free blacks who own other blacks. That wouldn't necessarily give them a boost in society. It might within certain parts of society, but that happened almost exclusively in New Orleans, where you've got so much mixed blood there among blacks and Indians and French that you had it, but it wasn't, you wouldn't normally have, say, a black slave owner in a place like Georgia. It's much more likely in a place like Louisiana. But along the same line as Zach's question, there were, we don't talk about this very often because it's not politically correct, but the American Indians of the South owned far more blacks per capita than whites ever did. Far more. it would have been even middle class Indians owned a number of slaves. But of course, they were moved to Oklahoma in the 30s. So they're not really seen as part of that. But yeah, slavery was much larger among American Indians than among whites. Yeah?
I was just wondering, what percentage of the population of the South was poor white? Is it marginal?
You mean this bottom part? Yeah, we're talking maybe 2-3%. Again, not much. About the smaller than free blacks, definitely. But they were really frowned upon. And in part of it, they were used as a moral lesson. If this is what happens, if you allow the white race to just destroy itself, they become worse than blacks. So in a lot of ways, this really was kind of, this is why we want to show you, we don't want this thing. These people are even more degraded than blacks are. And therefore, because they had the opportunity to not have that happen, unlike most blacks, it makes them much worse. So that's great. Yeah, same, last question.
Yeah, so were the white trash really fairly concentrated along with the Appalachian
spine? Oh, always. Yeah, they're always in the Scotch-Irish areas. And again, they are Scotch-Irish, but most Scotch-Irish are respectable. They just tend to be the fringes of Scotch-Irish culture. So if any of you are interested in this, there's a fantastic book called Cracker Culture, which was written in the 1980s, all about the history of old white trash that takes it up to today. Very good. So, okay, thanks everybody. Great class. I'll see you on Thursday.